Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Kristen Espelon has a report on how voters are feeling post-election. First, Kentucky voters followed pre-election polls, keeping Mitch McConnell in office and electing four Republicans and two Democrats to Congress. Now all of them must tackle the challenges facing the nation and the Commonwealth. Gabe Bullard has more.
At the downtown Louisville party for Kentucky Democrats, the most watched race was between Bruce Lunsford and Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. In the weeks leading up to the election, polls showed Lunsford gaining on his powerful opponent. As the first election results came in from eastern Kentucky, the two candidates were effectively tied. That's when Lunsford spokesperson Carrie Stimley said the campaign would need big gains in Lexington and Louisville.
We'll be watching very closely as we come to the middle of the state, and I think we need to be pretty far ahead to sustain that Western Kentucky surge that tends to happen for the Republicans.
But Lunsford didn't get those numbers and conceded the race shortly after 10.
Lunsford did not completely solve the problems that he has had with certain Democrats. Some of them simply don't like him and won't ever like him.
Al Cross is director of the Institute for Rural Journalism at the University of Kentucky and a longtime political writer. He says Lunsford needed help appealing to Democrats, help that could have come from Barack Obama, who didn't campaign in Kentucky.
Obama wins friends about anywhere he goes, but he did not see Kentucky as a useful place to invest time. It would have taken many visits in the state to turn it around for him.
Obama won the election without Kentucky, and Cross says the decision to forego the state helped Senator Mitch McConnell win a fifth term. But Senior Brookings Institute fellow Sarah Bender says McConnell will face challenges.
He is not nearly the sort of firebrand conservative that many of his Republican colleagues are. And I think he will feel pressure from the right to redefine the conservative's Republican label in the Senate and to pull that core of Republicans further to the right.
McConnell is the most powerful Republican in Congress, but he'll be the most powerful Republican in Washington once Obama is in the White House. Bender says McConnell's power may be diminished since the minority he leads is smaller, but he will still have significant control over shaping his party's legislative strategy.
A lot will depend on, in fact, on where President-elect Obama positions those policy priorities himself, right? Does he go to the center of the spectrum and push proposals that could pick up bipartisan support, or does he rear farther to the left, putting Republicans on guard against cooperating?
The Democrats weren't without congressional victories on election night. Congressman John Yarmuth will return to Capitol Hill for a second term. In his victory speech, Yarmuth urged Democrats not to misuse their stronger majorities. Bender says this year's Democratic victories are more of a referendum on the Bush administration than a mandate for the party, but legislators may not see it that way.
Majority parties have never been very good about sharing power with minority party colleagues. When House Republicans took over the House in 95, they were not very good about sharing power, and we saw the same thing under Speaker Pelosi.
Bender says there are major economic issues the newly elected Congress and president must take on immediately. She says partisanship would likely make McConnell's job of rebuilding his party easier, and that could lead to another shift in congressional power in 2010. When all of the House seats and 34 Senate positions are up for grabs. For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
The election may be over, but Democrats and Republicans alike are still reeling from what happened. Kristen Espelon spoke to some of Louisville's youngest and oldest voters to find out what they're making of the historic results.
Howard Foster is sitting quietly in the sunny lobby of his assisted living apartment building. He cast his first vote for president in 1932 when Democrat Franklin Roosevelt took on Republican Herbert Hoover. The Great Depression was ravaging the nation, and voters wanted change. This year's election sounded the echoes of that era in many ways, except this time an African American won the White House. Foster is giddy.
Oh, it's great. It's great. How I feel. I can't believe it, because now I'm waiting to see what he's going to do.
At a senior center downtown Louisville, seniors are holding an indoor yard sale. Betty has piled her table with sweaters and costume jewelry. The first election in which she was eligible to vote was in 1964. At that time, she could vote, but she wasn't allowed in the movie theater on 4th Street in a still-segregated Louisville. She says she has mixed feelings about the election.
I'm a lady and I'm worried because it's a mess. He's coming into a mess and it's going to take a whole lot to get him out of it. and we all have to work together to do this. Everybody's glad and proud and everything, but we also got to understand that it's coming into a mess, and it's going to take something to get us out of it.
Young voters share some of those concerns, and they have others. University of Louisville freshman Kirsten Kirkland is breezing into the Student Activity Center. She's dressed for track practice. She says she's excited about Barack Obama's win, but she's not sure everyone can handle it.
But at the same time, I'm very nervous and worried about, you know, his family's, you know, life. People have already tried to kill him before he got officially won the election.
This was also the first presidential election for freshman Bo Eggers. He says he voted for McCain, but he's ready to move forward.
Kind of excited that it's over, just because all the political ads and all that, a lot of negative. But I think it's more, now we can focus on more of the positive, so, and actually get things done.
Older McCain supporters expressed the same desire to move forward and get cracking on fixing some of the country's ills. Ray Thomas is working a crossword puzzle in a reclining chair in his apartment. He says the next president has his work cut out for him, from the economy to foreign wars.
And I wish President Obama my best with the situation he's got to go through. I was born a Republican and I voted Republican, but I'm not a sore loser.
Downstairs in the apartment building's activity room, Gertrude Gay isn't as sanguine about the election's winner. As a World War II vet who served as a nurse in Normandy, Gay says she identified more with McCain.
I feel I'm open to what is going to happen, of course. I was very much for McCain because he was a veteran.
All of these voters share the belief that this election was indeed historic, with the first serious possibility that a woman could be vice president or an African American the president. And they all feel anxious about what lies ahead. The nation is in dire straits, from the economy to our image overseas. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
You can read more of WFPL's election coverage at our website, WFPL.org. This week, the Center for Interfaith Relations begins the 13th Annual Festival of Faiths. This year's theme, Coming of Age. Elizabeth Kramer spoke with the center's Mark Steiner about what the festival aims to achieve in this community and a few of its legacies.
This year, the festival's theme is Coming of Age. What does that mean?
Well, it refers both to the individual's journey in our own maturation process, our own coming of age as members of a community, but what does it mean to come of age as a community? What does it mean to come of age or mature as a species?
And will there be any answers that people can find within the events of the festival?
I certainly hope so. I certainly believe so.
And how did you choose this year's theme and create events to reflect it?
Well, past festival chairs and Center for Interfaith Relations members came up with the idea to do a four-year series of themes around different aspects of life or cycles of life. So we've done death and dying, birth and creation. Now we're doing coming of age, to be followed next year by marriage.
How does the theme reflect the tone of the times and the local communities?
Well, I think that it's always going to be timely to look at the issue of what does it mean to come of age and what do we need to do next in our own journey. For our local community, I think some of the ways we see this is that we're starting to look at issues of sustainability, for example. And I think that you could equate sustainability with maturation or coming of age. In order to be a mature functioning society or community, we need to be a sustainable community. So there are several programs this year that really start to address issues of sustainability, from our relationship with the environment to the food economy, etc.
And who are some of the speakers that will be tying into that theme and addressing those issues?
Well, Winona LaDuke, well-known Native American activist and former Green Party vice presidential candidate, we'll be addressing that both on a political level and in relationship to agriculture. Brian Swim will be looking at what it means to come of age as a species with his talk on developing a global mind and heart. Stephen Prothrow, he's the chair of religion at Boston University, but is also the author of a few New York Times bestsellers, most recently the book Religious Literacy, What Every American Needs to Know and Doesn't. So he's bringing up this question of, are we doing a disservice to our youth and to our culture by not including religious education in our public education process? because we're becoming such a diverse culture that not knowing each other becomes an issue of not understanding each other, which can then lead to misunderstanding, if you will.
And what kind of religious education does he propose?
Well, he's very smart about it in saying that we need information, not indoctrination. You know, that we really do need to understand, though, the details, the traditions. And I think with the idea that we'll find that when we learn about each other, we discover we have an awful lot in common and there's not really much to fear. But that lack of knowledge, I think, often can lead to fear and misunderstanding.
And what are some of the changes that have been made in the festival this year?
A big shift is trying to move deeper into the community. We have a broader range of events this year with more than 36 events. But a major change is that they're taking place at over 24 locations in town. So while we'll be stationed at the convention center downtown Monday evening through Thursday evening, throughout the week, we are all over the Metro Louisville area.
Why was that change decided upon?
Well, we see the festival as being a community event. And so it's quite appropriate, we thought, to engage the community more in the planning process and to invite the community to host the events.
And how did you include the community in the planning process?
Inviting them to the table. You know, we have meetings pretty early on. We'll start in January looking at getting to the nitty-gritties of the next year's festival. And so we just begin to invite a variety of players to the table, if you will, and discuss what's possible and how they might contribute.
And who are those players?
It's very wide-ranging this year, including various houses of worship, of course, across the community, but also Bellarmine University, local organizations like the Peace Education Program. There are, I think, at least 30 different community partners, ranging from religious communities to other organizations promoting peace and interfaith work.
And what is the range of the religious communities who are involved?
Well, we have folks involved throughout the Christian traditions, within the Jewish faith, the Muslim tradition, as well as Buddhist, Hindu, Baha'i.
There's been a subject that's been a thread throughout several festivals, being the environment. And can you explain why that has developed and how that manifests itself in the festival?
Well, let me start off by saying that the Center for Interfaith Relations, the host of the Festival of Faiths, our slogan is many faiths, one heart, common action. And when it comes to common action, what do we have in common more than the planet itself? The future of humans and other species really relies on our ability to get into a healthier relationship with the planet. And this is an issue that's come alive within religious traditions. And so it's a very easy bridge to work across faith traditions on this very common problem of making our planet sustainable for future generations.
And how will environmental issues or subjects be addressed in this year's festival?
We have speakers that is their forte. In addition to Brian Swim, who has a very much an ecological focus, we have Mary Evelyn Tucker, who is one of the premier scholars on the connections between faith and ecology. She is co-director of a program at Yale University on faith and ecology. We also have a film screening, the film Renewal, which is about the relationship between religion and environmentalism. The programs with Mary Evelyn Tucker include a look at the Earth Charter, which is a very amazing document that cities and countries are being invited to sign on to create a sustainable global society, if you will. So these are some of the programs, as well as a lunchtime discussion with the folks at Kentucky Interfaith Power and Light, who help to facilitate congregations becoming more green.
How do they do that?
Basics like teaching them some of the simplistic ways to reduce energy use, to helping them provide education and information to their congregations about the importance of the issue and the issue's connection to their faith tradition and sacred text.
And when the festival has finished, what do you as organizers hope that lasts?
That's a really great question, Elizabeth, and one that we continue to try to focus on as far as how can we see that this is not just a one-off experience. One of the things is that we hope to really raise a serious discussion in the local educational community about religious literacy that we hope will have impact on education and Louisville's future. We also hope to sow the seeds for a variety of follow-up projects supporting such efforts as the greening of congregations, supporting the idea that maybe we need to re-examine our coming-of-age rites and rituals and see that they become more grounded in what it really does mean to become a grown-up in our society. And we hope to do some follow-up workshops and study groups based on some of the material that we'll be presenting at the festival.
Are there some concrete results that have come out of previous festivals?
Certainly last year, one of our featured guests were the three women who wrote the book, The Faith Club, a Muslim, a Jew, and a Christian who got together and began to explore their faith traditions amongst themselves. And as a direct result of their being at the festival, there have been a few groups that have begun to meet locally across faith traditions, and we've seen some direct community building as a result of that. So that's a minor, but I think important example. As long as we are building community and getting to know each other and finding and even celebrating our commonality, we are impacting our community.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Elizabeth Kramer speaking with Mark Steiner of Louisville's Center for Interfaith Relations about this year's Festival of Faiths. When we come back, I'll talk with filmmaker Stefan Forbes about his new Frontline documentary. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Robin Fisher talks with Daniel Boone biographer Meredith Mason Brown. First, in the world of hardball national politics, few people have made more of an impact than the late Lee Atwater. Atwater was a controversial Republican strategist and political consultant who masterminded George H.W. Bush's victory over Michael Dukakis in the 1988 presidential race, which included the infamous Willie Horton television ad. Atwater died from a brain tumor in 1991 at the age of 41. Lee Atwater is the subject of a new documentary by filmmaker Stefan Forbes that will air this week on the PBS Frontline program. It's called Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater Story. I spoke with Forbes about Atwater and his film. He begins by talking about his fascination with Atwater's life story.
Got a guitar picker from South Carolina who rises up to play a key role in electing Ronald Reagan, which I didn't even know about. But he single-handedly creates the Bush dynasty, becomes a mentor to Karl Rove. He really teaches these guys how to campaign and how to win. And I found out that he was even winning elections after his death. You know, his playbook played a very big role in W's win in 2000 and again in 2004.
How did he get involved in politics? Where did he cut his teeth?
Well, Strom Thurmond was his mentor. And, you know, a lot of people see the racial side of Strom Thurmond that we all know about. But Strom, you know, when you had the McCain camp calling Obama a socialist, that was straight out of the Strom Thurmond playbook, too. These guys created the culture war down south. They understood how to make the other guys seem like elitists who didn't really love the flag. And Atwater learned that, you know, straight from a brilliant operative like Strom Thurmond.
And how did he come to be a Republican, or did it really matter? Was he just more interested in the game itself?
Exactly. I mean, all his friends told me, you know, we are surprised he went to the party of the fuddy-duddies, the country club set. And again, it was so interesting to find out that Atwater, as a Southerner, had that deep resentment of the North, these guys that came down in the Civil War and acted morally superior to the South when there was racism up North as well. Then again in the Civil Rights Movement, you know, telling the South how to do things. And he played off that mistrust of government to get people to really sort of demonize the government. Ronald Reagan said, you know, never trust these people to say, I'm here from the government, try to fix things for you. So Atwater expertly understood those feelings in the South. And as his protege, Tucker Eskey, told me, resentment became the future of the Republican Party in the Atwater playbook.
I heard someone say in the film, as long as the GOP continued to be grand and old, there wouldn't be much of a party.
Exactly. Atwater understood they needed the youth. And this is back in the 60s. You know, Hollywood was a lot of Democrats there. All the rock stars were Democrats. All the celebrities were Democrat. The Republican Party, their rock star was Lee Atwater. And that's why he's still a legend today in the party. So many people look up to him. He trained a whole generation of operatives, and you see his influence, you know, all through the McCain campaign.
When did he emerge on the national scene? Was it during the Reagan years?
Yeah, pretty much that 1980 race down in South Carolina. Reagan's coming down, faces this tough test in John Connally, the Texan. Connally, all the smart money was on him. He even had Strom Thurmond backing him in South Carolina. Lee Atwater, I found out, leaked a story to a friend of his that was a reporter saying that Connally was bribing black ministers to get out the vote. And once that got around, Connally spent $10 million and got one delegate, and Ronald Reagan went on to have a little bit of success in politics.
To say the least. And, of course, he goes on, Atwater goes on to be the mastermind behind the George H.W. Bush campaign and that infamous Willie Horton ad. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, race has played such a big part in the ascendancy of the Republican Party, and Atwater was a master keeping it just under the surface using these powerful fear techniques. He found this guy who got out of prison on a furlough and, you know, done some violence, and it was a masterful touch. It distracted the whole country from Iran-Contra. The fact that Ronald Reagan had just sold arms to terrorists and lied about it on national TV, Lee knew how to change the subject. He had this hold over the media. He knew the sticky stories that would really captivate them. And that whole election became about this guy, Willie Horton, and it worked incredibly well. Now, in my movie, legendary Republican operative Roger Stone claims that Atwater was illegally bankrolling this ad, which supposedly a political action committee, nothing to do with the campaign. Stone says Atwater was funneling millions of dollars to them, which is a fascinating allegation that I think people are going to be looking into.
Who else did you talk to for the film?
You know, Atwater's friends just find him such a legendary figure that I talked to people like Mary Madeline, elite strategist for the Republicans, Ed Rollins, who was Reagan's campaign manager. He talks about Atwater as the most intense relationship in his life, even more so than any of his three wives. I mean, he wanted to murder Atwater. He was, you know, best friends with him. Then on his deathbed, he forgave him and he shed tears at his funeral.
Hmm. Well, in politics, obviously, you make enemies, but Atwater was kind of disliked by some in his own party as well, as you mentioned.
Yeah, a very controversial figure, you know. I mean, he destroyed Republicans just as much as he destroyed Democrats. Everyone was scared to go up against this guy. And ultimately, you know, it's the story of this win-at-all-costs playbook. You know, he was the Vince Lombardi of American politics. And Howard Fineman, senior writer for Newsweek, told me, you know, he made the Republican Party a Southern party. And he gave power to these evangelicals and these Christian conservatives that Atwater privately mocked. He called them the guys with the third eyes and the hands growing out of their heads. And we see now there is a civil war going on after this election between those guys who forced John McCain to choose Sarah Palin and between the sort of more moderate wing, you know, with the intellectuals, the people that wanted a Tom Ridge or maybe a Joe Lieberman to be the VP pick. And it's going to be really interesting to see how Atwater's influence is dividing the party in the next few years as they struggle to find their new modern identity.
Now, of course, he was diagnosed with a brain tumor in 1990, died young, I think at the age of 41, and he spent some time sort of searching for redemption, you talk about in the film.
Yeah, it was a fascinating story, too, because America loves that redemption story, you know. We're a country that likes to sin on Saturday night and get down on our knees and pray about it Sunday morning. And when Atwater began searching for truth, you know, it was fascinating to people that this cynical, amoral guy, suddenly he gets cancer and his whole philosophy is no good to him. And Tucker Eskew, again, Atwater's protege, who was a senior advisor to the McCain-Palin campaign, told me He was desperately afraid of going to hell. The fear tactics that Atwater used on America so effectively, making us scared of black people or scared of terrorists, came back on him, and it was really his dark night of the soul. And I believe, personally, that a lot of that was very sincere. Atwater was looking for something deeper, a deeper truth, but people disagree about whether or not he found it.
Now, the film is titled Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater story. How did you come up with that title?
Well, it works on all these different levels because Atwater loved to play the blues. He got up there and jammed with B.B. King, so there's the boogie there. He became the Democrats' boogeyman. You know, they demonized him. They fell into his whole sort of salesman pitch that he's this political assassin. He wanted to intimidate them. Ultimately, however, he became a boogeyman in the media. One Democratic congressman, Pat Schroeder, called him the most evil man in America. And he was not able to shake that image. And ultimately, the boogeyman, Willie Horton, America's worst fears. He knew what was in our hearts, and he knew how to scare us. So, again, this idea of the boogeyman that can control us by our own fears is interesting to me because America's such a macho country. We love our football and our pickup trucks, but fear works on us very often in politics.
And he was quite an accomplished musician, wasn't he?
Well, when I started making the movie, I thought I was going to discover another Duane Allman or some incredible guitar player because I read so much of the press about him. Rolling Stone magazine made him sound like, you know, the guy was absolutely unbelievable. What he was a virtuoso at is spinning the media. That was really his talent, and he could get these guys to print anything because he, you know, they thought he was this country rube. He would play a role. His motto was play dumb and keep moving. But actually, Atwater had been to grad school. He had a degree in communications, and he realized the weak points of the media, how they're in a rush. They don't really source a lot of these stories with two or three different people. They just sort of put it up there and run it out like a conveyor belt, as Sam Donaldson told me. And Atwater appealed to their cynicism. You know, he had another saying, you know, wrestling is the only honest sport in town. Because it's so obviously fake. And that's what politics was to him. It was just like pro wrestling.
So he was a pretty good musician, but no Duane Allman is what you're saying.
Definitely not. But, you know, again, he was fearless. He would get up there on stage with anybody and play that guitar. And it was that fearless fighting spirit that made him a hero to a whole generation of Republican operatives.
Well, still a major looming presence nearly two decades after his death.
It is, and it's such an amazing story that here this guy claws his way to the heights of power. Again, the South often ignored, especially in the Democratic Party. They didn't realize that if Atwater made it seem like they didn't love the flag, that they weren't, you know, an ally of the working man, that they didn't really believe in the Bible, that they were going to be marginalized in American politics, and his playbook probably beat Al Gore and John Kerry long after he was gone. So I really want to talk to his closest friends and find out how he did it, because it's a pretty amazing story.
The name of the film is Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater Story. It airs Tuesday, November 11th, 9 p.m. on the Frontline, part of the Frontline series on PBS. Stefan Forbes, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Learn more about Lee Atwater and Stefan Forbes' documentary at our website, WFPL.org. Daniel Boone, frontiersman, explorer, embodiment of the American spirit. Since the first biography of Boone appeared in 1784, historians and history buffs have been fascinated by his adventures, true or not. Historian and author Meredith Mason Brown also could not resist the call to tell more of the Daniel Boone story. Brown took some time to talk with Robin Fisher about his Boone biography, Frontiersman, Daniel Boone, and the Making of America.
Well, so I'm going to start with the obvious question. Why another book on Boone?
Couldn't resist. he's an extremely interesting person, and everyone who looks at him from a different perspective, and I think gets something new and different out of that process. But it is true that I couldn't resist. I liked the character of Daniel Boone, and I also found that he was a wonderful window into a long period of American history. So it was a way to tell the story of what was happening in America between 1734, when Boone is born, and 1820, when he dies. That's 85 years, if you can imagine somebody living that long in times as perilous as those.
Well, you know, something that I found very interesting about the book, or about Boone, was, you know, you think of him as being sort of the quintessential American frontiersman. But his loyalties, along, you know, I think sort of with the mode of the time, his loyalties were sort of all over the board.
That's exactly right. It's an illustration. We think of ourselves as Americans, but was Daniel Boone an American? He's born in 1734. There isn't such a thing. There isn't a Declaration of Independence for another 42 years. So he's a Pennsylvanian. He's born 50 miles from the Atlantic in Exeter, Pennsylvania. He travels through Virginia. He and his family live in North Carolina. He begins hunting in Kentucky. It's not yet part of America. It's still part of Virginia. And then for a while he's a Shawnee, because he's taken captive by the Shawnees in 1778. He becomes an adopted son of a Shawnee chief. He learns to speak some Shawnee, gets on very well with the Shawnee adoptive family, and then he escapes when he realizes they're going to be attacking Boonesboro, and he goes back to help lead the defense and fights the Shawnee. So his loyalties move around, and then for a while he's clearly an American. He becomes a colonel in the militia. He becomes a legislator in representing that part of Kentucky and Virginia. 1799, he's had it with Kentucky, and he moves out to Missouri. But Missouri isn't Missouri. It's still part of the Spanish territory of Louisiana. So he becomes a Spanish civil official and also local military leader. So he had to have taken an oath of allegiance of some sort to the Spanish king. And that only lasts for a few years, because then there's the Louisiana Purchase, and once again he's an American. So you're exactly right, Robin. This is an illustration of the changing loyalties on the frontier.
It's just amazing to me, you mentioned it earlier, that he lived 85 years.
Yes.
He outlived
a couple of months at 86.
At most of his family. He outlived most of his family.
Yes, except he had loads of children. He had 10 children. He was one of 11. There are, if you do the math of however many generations there have been since then, and even if you were to ascribe only 5 or 6 that make it to adulthood and childbearing, there must be 1 million descendants of Daniel, or at least of Daniel's father, at this time.
You know, he's very important to Kentucky, obviously.
Yes.
And
although the last 20 years of his life, he was in Missouri.
I feel like we do sort of claim him as our own. And he pretty much opened the way to Kentucky, even though he wasn't really the first settler here.
Right. Right. He starts as a young man hunting. And, of course, the more you hunt, the more you kill, the more you have to move around to find new game to kill. So he's going westward, and he goes west and north from the Yadkin Valley, which is where he was, up through the Cumberland Gap, and begins being one of the early market hunters in Kentucky. And then he leads settlers into Kentucky, tries it in 1773, gets pushed back by Indian attack that kills his firstborn son. Tries it again successfully in 1775. So he is, for a long time, a Kentuckian. And then, of course, he moves out to Missouri and dies out there. And he has to be then brought back after his death to be a Kentuckian again, as you know, Robin.
With all the myths out there about Daniel Boone, was it tough to get to the facts?
You do have to do a fair amount of mythologizing. For instance, he didn't actually wear a coonskin cap. This is some people find it as a great shock, but his son Nathan says, "My father despised raccoon fur caps and never wore one, as he always had a hat." So that's one myth. There's some wonderful myths. If you look at some of the early biographies in the 19th century of Boone swinging on vines when he's pursued by Indians so as not to leave footsteps. Sorry about that one, but that one isn't true either. And then there are things like pieces of the true cross, relics of Boone that aren't quite right. There are trees that have carved in them, "D. Boone kilt a bar on this tree," but they spell Boone B-O-O-N without a final E. And Boone, who was literate, by the way, always signed his name with a final E. So those are probably like pieces of the true cross.
Why do you think that we have needed him to be larger than life?
It fit different people's needs at different times. The first biography is written when Boone is still alive. He's 50 years old. It's 1784. And Boone encouraged the writing. That is by John Filson, after whom the Filson Club is named. And John Filson was, like Boone, a speculator in Kentucky land and was trying to promote Kentucky land. So he was saying how wonderful the land was, and he was also saying, and here's Boone who's done these things and largely reduced the Indian threat, so come on out and buy land, including the land that's the subject of the warrants that I've just invested in. But of course he doesn't disclose that part. And then later on, if you are engaged in moving the Indians out of the eastern United States out to the west, it served the people in the 1840s and 50s to kind of demonize the Indians and make them as vicious killers of the white settlers. So that was done, although that was a addition too, because Boone was not a person who killed whatever Indian he saw. He did it when he needed to, and he didn't do it very often. So it served a need to create these different myths of Boone, and that's equally true in art and in sculpture, as well as in history or pseudo history, or as some of these biographies were.
Now we call that creative nonfiction.
There you go.
What is your personal connection to Boone?
Well, he's been a part of my life since I was a kid. My father was born in Louisville, and his parents and parents' parents and so forth back were from Kentucky before there was a state of Kentucky, going back to a John Brown who came out in 1783 and ultimately was one of the first two senators in Kentucky. That John Brown was Daniel Boone's lawyer, another relative who was John Brown's uncle, was the person who commissioned Daniel Boone in 1774 as a captain in the Virginia militia. And so it goes, there's another relative named John Floyd who, with Daniel Boone, rescued Daniel Boone's daughter Jemima and two other girls when they were taken captive by the Shawnees and some Cherokees in 1776. And that rifle hung on the wall of my father's study, so when I was a kid, you'd see this 5-foot rifle, and it made an impression. And my father wrote a book on Daniel Boone himself for young adults. This is part of, you're too young to know this, Robin, but there was the Landmark series of books for 11 to 16 year olds, and he wrote such a book and tried it out on me paragraph by paragraph because I was a target audience. I was 11 years old in the year 1952 when this book was written.
So Boone's been with you forever.
He's been with me forever. I discovered more links when I got into this. I realized that when the bones were moved back in 1845, 25 years after Boone died. The person leading that was Senator John Brown's son, Mason, who brought the bones back, and there was a new cemetery being built in Frankfort, and this was to be the cornerstone of the new cemetery. And before they were buried, there was a party of the dignitaries who had arranged this, and Mason Brown took the skull of Daniel Boone and put it in the hands of an 8-year-old boy and his son, and say, "Now you can say you've lifted the skull of Daniel Boone." And that was my father's grandfather. I hadn't realized that before I began working on this book.
Was there anything that you were surprised to learn about Daniel Boone?
Plenty. I knew that he had enormous stamina and enormous bravery. I didn't realize, because I don't think other people have explored it so much, his efforts to become rich, his work as an economic person. He was a land speculator. He was a surveyor. He was not a very successful business person. He didn't do well in most of these efforts. He kept a tavern. He even joined the international global market by trying to make some money digging and trading in ginseng when he realized that the Chinese were paying large amounts of money for ginseng. So that was a discovery. And he was a fighter, but it was a discovery to realize that, as he said, that people say, "I killed a host of Indians, but I never killed but three." He actually said, "I never killed but three that I claimed, but many's the fair fire that I had at them." But he only had the fair fire at them when they were taking his daughter captive, or when they were attacking Boonesboro, or when he was on a punitive expedition into the Shawnee territory or the like. Another discovery was, not a discovery because I knew this from my father's book, but he was a Quaker. So here's the great Indian fighter, at least in the mid-19th century biographies, who is also presumably raised as somebody who is a pacifist when he possibly can be.
Well, it sounds like there is a lot to learn. Thank you very much for your time today.
It's my pleasure.
That was Robin Fisher talking with author Meredith Mason Brown about his new book, Frontiersman, Daniel Boone and the Making of America. Brown will speak at the Filson Historical Society Thursday evening at 6. Details are at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Gabe Buller talks with University of Louisville professor Joy Gleason-Carew about her book, Blacks, Reds, and Russians, Sojourners in Search of the Soviet Promise. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. In the first half of the 20th century, hundreds of African Americans left the United States to visit and settle in the Soviet Union. Author and University of Louisville professor Joy Gleason-Carew explores this immigration in her book, Blacks, Reds, and Russians, Sojourners in Search of the Soviet Promise. She spoke with Gabe Bullard about the book.
How did you come to write about this particular topic?
Well, my background is actually in Russian studies. I did Russian and French in high school and then through college, so my undergrad degrees are a double degree in Russian and French. I also traveled to what was then the Soviet Union many times in the 60s and 70s, including in the 70s taking several groups of not only my students but professionals over for sort of people-to-people contacts. And over the years, I grew more and more fascinated with looking at the historical connections between people of color, particularly African Americans, and the Soviet people, or the Russian and Soviet Union, the Russian people and Soviet Union. I also had a particular interest because my folks had traveled there in the earliest days of the Khrushchev era and had some interesting stories to tell about the unusually hospitable treatment they received there in the 50s by comparison to what African Americans were experiencing in the U.S. So over the years, I had my own personal studies. I had my love of Russian literature and travels there to think about. I'd come to know some descendants of people who had actually grown up there, who you would call Afro-Russians, and wanted to put this story together in a way that was much more accessible to a reading public. I knew little bits and pieces of history about people who had gone there, some who just simply traveled there, others who had gone there and lived there, but there weren't very many sources for people to read to get the full panoply of the experience of the interconnections between the Soviet Union and peoples of color.
How welcoming was the Soviet Union?
It was very welcoming, certainly in the early days when I traveled, which were the late 60s as a student, and then through the 70s when I, as I said, I took many groups myself. And looking back in history in the 20s and 30s when there was the initial interest in the Soviet experiment by such figures as Langston Hughes and W.B. Du Bois and Robeson and others who went, clearly the Soviet experiment offered some intriguing possibilities for people who were fed up with the struggle against Jim Crow and lynch laws and other things that discriminated against and basically terrorized blacks into submission in this society. So when people were traveling to this country in formation, which promised to be non-racial and to celebrate the worker and talent such as people had, it was quite an exciting opportunity for them. And for those that did travel there in the 20s and then in the 30s in particular, many of them found some unusual opportunities that even they had only just hoped for.
Was there racism in the Soviet Union in the 20s and 30s?
There was not. Well, let's put it this way. Racism was not something that would be tolerated under the system because, of course, the contention was this was a society of equals, and therefore those who were the most downtrodden would be those who would be welcomed even more so. And for the Russian people, there was a particular sympathy for blacks that had come up out of the struggle of civil war and then emancipation, very similar to being released from serfdom. And so in those early days, the idea of brotherhood was something that was publicly spoken about. Anything that rose up otherwise was dealt with very quickly. And in most of the cases for those blacks, particularly the African Americans or people who went from the U.S. over there, in their accounts, it turns out that when they did experience incidents of racism, it was usually at the hands of foreigners like other Americans who traveled there. Incidentally, it wasn't just black Americans who traveled there, but white Americans went there in large numbers in the late 20s and 30s because of the interest in this new social experiment.
So the Soviet system, you're saying, was inherently closed to racism, that it couldn't exist under the textbook written example of that system.
Racism, as was experienced in the United States in particular, was a systematic deprivation, an attempt to deprive people of not only physical opportunity, but a spiritual opportunity. Du Bois refers to this as the veil and the problems of double consciousness, where you even doubt your own self and your abilities. The Soviet Union, as it was being constructed in the 20s and 30s, was a country on the move. It was creating a new society. And for blacks who had skills in particular, I'm thinking about those who went as agricultural specialists or technical specialists who received Soviet contracts, suddenly here was a country that was welcoming people with skills that were being denied here in the United States.
That was University of Louisville professor Joy Gleason Carew, author of Blacks, Reds, and Russians, Sojourners in Search of the Soviet Promise. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM. which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.